Session number 10314, Mr. Ronald Brierley, part one.
Can you tell me, first of all, Mr. Brierley, when it was and how it was that you came to join SOE?
Yes, I joined SOE in 1943. In those days, I was a radio operator with 146 Regiment, Royal Armoured Corps, which was, of course, a tank regiment. And I was a radio operator, operating in the reconnaissance section, scout cars and that sort of thing. And early in 1943, life was fairly quiet, and I suppose as a young soldier one was a bit anxious to get into the action. And a notice came on the squadron notice board one day, inviting people who had some experience of radio operating, radio work, and they were prepared to undertake parachute training to volunteer, as was then indicated, for some form of operation in Yugoslavia. And so I put my name down for this, being a bit browned off at the time, and duly went off to be interviewed at some college in Oxford. We spent 3 or 4 days undergoing various tests, various initiative and aptitude tests, the usual sort of stuff.
What type of things did they seem to be after at the interview?
Well, they were the old psychologists were turned loose on you with all the sort of matching squares and all the usual stuff, and see what, make some assessment of your intelligence. Then you were there was the usual type of assault course to see whether you're in reasonable state of fitness, and really the sort of thing that you find in a management school today, with aptitude tests, initiative tests, and working in little groups. And obviously you were being watched during the course of this thing to see how you performed and one thing and another.
Were you at this stage told the type of thing that you would be let in?
No, not at this stage. Not at this stage. One was just given an indication that it would involve parachute training. You were a radio operator, so you didn't really need an awful lot of intelligence to judge that it was a question of probably going into Yugoslavia to operate with some form of partisan group or something of that nature. And of course, at that time, Mihailovic was the leader in Yugoslavia. And quite a lot of support was being given to Mihailovic with his partisans. It wasn't until Tito came along later, and then the Mihailovic-Tito argument started, that he really came into the centre. So, after these aptitude tests and one thing or other, we went back to our various units. There must have been about 40 or 50 of us there, drawn from different, mainly Armoured Corps unit, some Royal Tank Regiment, some Royal Signals. Nearly all chaps who had got some rudimentary knowledge of radio, knew the Morse code, and were probably engaged in doing reconnaissance work, Armoured Corps and that sort of thing. Back to our units, and then after about, almost forgotten about the thing, after about 3 months, we were suddenly summoned to parade at Henley-on-Thames. And there was a place at Henley-on-Thames called Fawley Court, a big house on the right on the Thames, which was a radio school, which was obviously one of the stately homes that SOE had such a knack of acquiring during the period of training. And it was the main radio and code school for operators, initiation. And so we went there, and there must have been about, this was purely a British contingent at that stage, probably about 40 of us, about 40 young fellows, mainly about sort of 21, 22, 23, that type of age group. And there we were immediately promoted to the rank of sergeant, which seemed a very good way to start one's career off in this new outfit. And we were told a little more that as to the sort of operation that was being planned. And we were trained from then on intensively in radio work. The first thing was to get our Morse code up to a really commercial speed, something with a rate of about 20 words a minute and that sort of thing. And we had our first initiation into the use of codes, elementary coding and that sort of thing. We'd been there for about a month, and then we were suddenly told that operations as far as Yugoslavia had been put on ice, and we were given the option of either transferring into other sections of SOE or returning to our unit. And most of us decided to transfer either to the Middle East section, which was channeling people into Greece and the Balkans, or into the French section. And I opted for the French section. Well, that's how I came to be in the French section of SOE.
Why did you want the French side?
Well, I had a little better than schoolboy knowledge of French, and it seemed, whilst it wasn't essential, it seemed a good starting point. Although at this stage it wasn't obligatory or anything of that nature. So we lost a few people went off to the Middle East, and the rest of us continued with our training at that stage. And then from there we went up into Scotland, we went to Dunbar, Scotland, which again was another advanced radio school, where we started doing a certain amount of field work. We were introduced to the latest type of portable radio sets that were becoming available, and we started working, out, going out 40, 50 miles away from Dunbar, and working back to Dunbar, and back to the school, and doing little exercises and that sort of, but still essentially radio work. Nothing else other than radio work and coding, and a certain element of physical training. To get, we were all reasonably fit then. That's a certain amount of extra PT started coming into the curriculum. And from then on, we went to Peterborough, to Milton Hall. And it was there that the JEDRA teams, as we were code names, started to come together. Because at Peterborough, we met up with French radio operators and French officers who were going to form part of the operational teams, British officers, and American officers and sergeants, again, who were going to become parts of the show.
Can you say what JEDRA teams were?
Yeah. JEDRA teams, in simple terms, were small teams of three. They consisted of an officer of the country to which you were designated. So if you went to France, there was automatically a French officer. There was then either a British officer or an American officer, and a British, a French, or an American radio operator. And the teams of three were, Peterborough was a sort of marriage bureau, if you like, where people started coming together. There was no particular, we all lived together, we messed together, we played together, we worked together, we learnt, we did our PT, played our games. We learned about explosives, we went into all sorts of exercises, one thing to get. And you made friendships, and gradually people sorted out their own teams. And in the end, there were 93 teams formed at Peterborough to go to France. Just stop it. The object of a JEDRA team was to have a small group of three people doing a number of things, but essentially to be a staff organisation to a militant fighting resistance group. That's what was conceived. In other words, it was known that in France there were lots of these small groups of Mackie or resistance people who were keen to come out into the field, They needed several things. They needed arms. To get arms, you needed communications. They needed guidance and leadership and liaison, and that meant somebody from the UK who knew what was available, what could be done in the way of support and the like. And they needed coordination, so that as and when D-Day was to come along, they would be, that would be the time when they would become efficient, active fighting units, and not just, I won't say, a sort of group of people interested in just promoting their own ends. In other words, there was to be some coordination of their effort in support of the Allied drive into Europe. And that was the object of the JEDBRAH teams, to provide this form of staff function for these small fighting units, which on busy would be of the order of about 200 or 300 men. Clearly, the radio operator was an absolutely vital part in this link, because without him, no way could you get regular supplies, no way could you be kept informed of targets and the like, and no way could you be directed from the centre of things, which was of course in London. So the, without wishing to sound big-headed at all, radio operators were really a very important link in this little party. At Peterborough, one at Milton Hall, as I say, one started coming together and meeting friends, finding compatibility with companions, because clearly it was going to be a fairly lonely sort of job going into an occupied country. One visualised that it was going to be, you were going to be dropped into areas of high concentration of enemy forces. In actual practice, that wasn't always the case, because France is a big country, and you know, the Germans were spread around in they were thick in certain areas, but many JEDBRAH teams went into areas where there was comparatively small enemy forces initially. But nevertheless, the concept of it was that you were going to be in isolation, and it was absolutely essential that you had compatibility between the three people concerned, and that they were ready to work together and live together, and do so in reasonable harmony and not be falling out and backbiting all the time. So I married up with an Englishman, a chap who was Ken Bennett. He was a journalist by profession. He was a major. And a Frenchman called Albert de Chernin, who free French officer. I didn't know at the time, but he was in point of fact a career diplomat, and indeed after the war he went on, he became French ambassador in Dublin and later in West Africa, and had quite a major career in the French diplomatic service. So that was the three of us. And once we came together, I suppose, which would be around probably August, September, 43, we then worked and did everything together as a small team. As far as JEDBRAHs were concerned, you worked as three individuals, but three individuals in complete harmony. One of the great joys of being a JEDBRAH, you weren't bedeviled with rank, and at last one didn't misuse that situation. Rank really didn't make very much difference. You were there to do a particular job and you got on with it. And then of course we came to Ringway here for our parachute training. We did the usual drops from balloons in the first place, and then later from the was the Whitley bomber that sort of fly out of Ringway and drop you into Tanton Park and that sort of thing. And from then on we did a series of very tough simulated exercises in various parts of the UK and Scotland to start familiarising us with the sort of work that we were going to have to do in the future. Training was very tough now. There was a lot of physical, good, hard physical training, because clearly one had to be fit. A lot of unarmed combat, continuous weapon training, particularly with small arms, because you weren't going to be capable of taking very much more with you than sort of Sten guns and carbines and that sort of thing. I'm cooperated with the RAF, learning about dropping zones, learning the techniques of setting up a DZ, a dropping zone, with fires or torches, and the established drill in that direction. And a lot of practical exercises in this country, again cooperating with the RAF in that direction, learning all about containers, what you can packed into a container in the way of weapons and ammunition and explosives. My role as radio operator, again, was to be able to undertake a certain amount of weapon training instruction, so that one had a part to play in that direction. The officer in charge of the three of you usually had the main responsibility for knowledge of explosives and handling of explosives and the like. And the like. And so this went on through until the early part of 44. And one had the benefit and the experience of talking to people that had been to France, coming back through the field, agents and the like, to give you the present day briefing as to what the situations were like.
What impression did these agents make on you?
Well, very often they were agents who'd been operating in some of the major centres, such as actually in Paris itself or in Marseille and that sort of thing. And clearly, as agents, theirs was a totally different sort of job to the type of thing we were going to expect to do. They tended to be somewhat scarifying in a way, because many of them come back with they'd either suffered quite badly and been tortured and managed to escape, or matters of that nature. There's some fairly hair-raising stories to tell. But on the other hand, the practical advice they were able to give was extremely useful.
Can you remember anything specific?
I remember specifically people coming back and talking to us about particular explosive techniques, particularly on a right and wrong way of dealing with small demolition jobs, small bridges and that sort of thing, where they were able to give us experience of the right way and the wrong way of going about things. I don't remember names, because again, names were not bandied about too freely. SOE was running very, very watertight compartments for obvious reasons. The less you knew about what was going on anywhere else, the better. And quite clearly, sometimes someone would come and he would just be referred to as Mr. X or Lieutenant X or something like that. So I can't say that I recollect any particular name coming back and giving us advice. Other than the advice that these people did come back was there were good, solid lessons to learn.
So, can you take me to the next stage?
Well, the next stage really started then, coming up to the operational stage proper. So far as the we came to the middle of May and the training was just continuing and one thing and another. But it's quite obvious that things were building up to a climax. And around the middle of May, odd teams started to disappear, and the drill was that you were called and you went to London to Baker Street. You had a 48-hour briefing in Baker Street, the area that you were going into, much information as possible about the area. You received all your detailed codes and the like, and then you went to Thamesford as the main area operations, perhaps two nights later, and you were away. And from the middle of May onwards, people just started disappearing and going off in that direction.
Did you associate all this with the Normandy landings?
Oh yes, oh yes. It was quite obvious that it was going to be part of an overall plan, part of an overall backup to the to two landings. We didn't know whether they were going to be in Normandy or where they were going to be. But clearly, there was going to be an invasion of Europe. And we were going to be a little part of it, a little part of a support group somewhere in that vast enterprise.
Which was the area you were designated for?
Well, at this stage one didn't know. Towards the middle of May, our group was called forward. And we went into Brittany. We were dropped in Brittany. We were dropped in Brittany at, I think the nearest town would be Saint-Brieuc. There's a little triangle in Brittany of Saint-Brieuc, Gangam, Saint-Malo. And we were dropped into that area.
Was the transfer from Britain smooth, or were there any hitches?
No problems at all. We went off to Baker Street and had our final briefing, collected our maps and all the rest of it. Bear in mind that we were going in uniform. This was another aspect about the Jebras that perhaps I've not made clear earlier, that we were to be uniform teams. We weren't attempting to be undercover agents or anything like that. We were going to be uniform teams who were going to assist the French resistance movement, the various Maquis, to play an active part in the liberation of their own country. So we were going to be dropped, and indeed we were dropped, in uniform. We had civilian clothes with us as well, but those were only to be used as necessary. But we were going in as uniformed soldiers, and indeed we all had an authority signed by General Koenig, confirming that we were indeed members of the armed forces. I have my little ink somewhere or other in that pile still, and the like.
For your own protection.
The theory was that you would be, if you were captured, you should be treated as a prisoner of war. In practice, one never expected that would apply at all, but it didn't, of course, as we know only too well. But one did have that little bit of paper which gave people some comfort. Anyway. So, into Brittany, and the operation in Brittany was...
What was your reception committee like in Sunday?
Well, we dropped in to a French agent. We went by Halifax bomber. We were duly dropped, the three of us, with a load of containers. We dropped to... an open country area with what struck us as being tremendously well illuminated, with these four great fires that formed the inverted letter L for the aircraft to recognise. It seemed, after all the training we'd had about going into a, the utmost security and the utmost tightness of security that we were dropped into bedlam, because there were people shouting and running about all over the place. And it felt as though you were in the middle of Piccadilly Circus almost. But we were assured the nearest Germans were about 30 miles away or something like that. So nobody seemed too worried about it. And then we were taken away from the dropping zone and to a safe farmhouse. And I established contact with London on my first attempt the following morning. And we were in business. And we had... from that time on, we met the local leaders of the resistance. But this is where my part of the function as a radio operator, and the part of the function of the other two, of the politicking and the leadership and control of the operation, really did in certain ways tend to move away from each other a little bit. My job was communications, essential. Their job was to get on with the organisation of the resistance group, with any such politicking. There was a certain amount of politicking between the sort of communists and non-communists and all that sort of thing. But I was to be protected and kept safe at all times, because I was the key to the communications. And without that little radio, we would have been completely out of touch with our source of supply, source of arms, source of explosives, and really just wouldn't have been very much use at all. So in a way, the radio operator had something of I wouldn't say a charmed life, but a degree of a protected life, and I had two fairly hefty minders wherever I went to make sure I was looked after and cared for and all the rest of it. It was quite an exacting job. I mean, you were to the actual transmission of the... We used to do two skeds a day, varying time. The actual transmission was easy. Relatively, you might get a bit of trouble with static and one thing or another, but in the main it was quite easy. But it was a fairly laborious job, coding messages and